Never had the pleasure to meet you.
Oh, that's fine. Tell me your name again.
Paul Dalby, Planet IRL.
Okay.
So I'm here with Howdy Bell, legendary broadcaster. Howdy, you came to the Speedway. You were on the radio network, I believe, 1961.
Two.
1962. All right, so you hear the legendary, let's see, Roger Ward that year.
True.
Fantastic races through the 60s. You've had a chance to work with all five voices of the 500. Sorry,
true.
With Sid for about 14 years, and then,
yep.
And then Bob and Lou and... Tell me a little bit about working with the different voices. It's been said we've gone from more of a variety show, if you will, with Sid, to a very play-by-play, what you see today. What changes have you seen in the last 50 years?
Well, that's what you just said is absolutely true. Sid was the focal point of the program. And back in those days, they would have all kinds of celebrities come in. You had to understand Sid's personality. He was a wonderful self-promoter, one of the best I'd ever known in my life. And he had a very large ego, and I don't say that in a negative way. That was Sid Collins. He was a wonderful self-promoter. But it was kind of the Sid Collins show, and the rest of us were a part of it. Where if you look forward to today, where Mike King is the anchor, it's more of a play-by-play, such as a football game or a basketball game or something like that. They try to give you as much race coverage as possible. In between, when Sid left, we had Paul Page come in as the next anchor. He was more or less handpicked by Sid. Paul did a good job, and that was probably the beginning of getting more to a play-by-play situation. Paul was kind of the first of a guy to take the focus off of Paul Page and spread it around to the rest of the people around the track. And back in those early days, Mr. Holman, when the network was formed in 52, Mr. Holman always wanted, since it was an Indianapolis event, to have broadcasters from every radio station in the city. And at that time, there were five AMs, basically. No FM yet. And that was true. So Paul was on a few years before he went to the network, and then when he left, I interviewed for the anchor job. There were several of us, Chuck Marlowe and I and Lou Palmer. And Lou was chosen, and Lou brought more to it as a personality, but yet it wasn't an ego personality, because he was so knowledgeable about the race himself. So you had a little different slant again when Lou was there. He was a pure newsman, and he was not a sports guy. And at least as far as I know, he never did any sports, but he was a good newsman. So that brought a little different perspective to it. And then Bob Jenkins came in, who was a guy who did NASCAR for years and years. And he even brought a different perspective from having done NASCAR on television all those years, and then coming into the open wheel racing arena. And so he brought, a little different style. Everybody has their own little style, but no one had the high ego vanity personality of Sid. And I'm not saying that in a negative, that was Sid. And then with Mike has even made it less of Mike and more of everybody.
Absolutely.
And I think that's good. And it's less of a showbiz, it's less of an entertainment tonight and more of a play-by-play event. And I think that's the way it is.
Now you brought up Lou Palmer. My first race was in 1988, his first year on
anchor.
The network, as the anchor right
yeah.
now. I listened to that race just not long ago. Did Lou ever really get comfortable as the anchor? I listened to that race, and it sounded to me like he, once he got in the seat, he almost kind of wished he was back on pit road where he had spent
so
many
years.
Well,
it's a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. I've heard Mike King say that. You have people in your ear all the time.
And I can tell you this from personal experience. And Mike said the same thing the other day. And I would venture that every person, including Sid Collins, had the same sensation. Because I'll tell you, if they didn't, I almost wouldn't give you a plug nickel for them. And that is, the day before, you have this fear that you won't wake up in time the next morning to be here. You'll miss the caravan, or there'll be something that will happen that you're not prepared for. And it haunts you. And I'm sure it haunted him, because Lou Palmer was a perfectionist. He really, really was. Not that the other people were led, but he was just that way. That was Lou's personality. And even I, as just a corner person, or in the tower with Bob those 9 or 10 years, it haunts you. You're afraid you won't wake up in time. You know, so you set 2 alarm clocks, and then, oh, what if something happens I'm not prepared for? And it really haunts you.
Now, where did you spend the majority of your time? I know you were in the booth in your
later years. I was more years than not. I was in turn two.
Okay.
And I was very comfortable over there.
Now, you were back in turn two when you were sitting on the wall. You weren't up in the.
Oh, that's right.
Before, you weren't up in the perch.
The suites weren't built. Yeah, we would sit in like an observer stand, a little green park bench with a little slanted roof on it. You know, it was identical to an observer stand. And I would sit on the seat and put my feet on the wall. I mean, we were right there. And when the race was over, of course, I wear glasses. When the race was over, I'd have the greasy smudge on my face, just as if I'd been out on the track. It was crazy.
Now, whereabouts in turn two were you? Exit, entry?
We were more in the middle, literally.
Okay. Now, if you look over there now,
it's almost through the turn.
Okay.
Now, mm-hmm. It's almost through the turn. So I would stay at that end. So I could see him from about halfway through the first turn, through the short chute, all the way through my turn, and you lose the identity of the car about halfway up the back. You can see it's a car, but you don't know who it is anymore, especially if there's a cluster. Mm-hmm. So by that time, I should have handed them off to whoever's in turn three at that, so they can see them coming toward them and pick them up. And one of the things you learn is, and Sid never dictated to us how much we should be out here. Some people have better memories than others. But I was, at the time, I was working at Channel 6 for a portion of that time. I was always out here every day anyway. I mean, I love racing. I love the 500. But you really need to learn the cars by color. And sometimes they screw you up, like the years that they had the 3 turbines, 20, 40, and 60. And the wedges, they all looked alike.
68.
And the question was raised, how are we supposed to recognize these guys? Which one is which? And I'm told, I wasn't in this conversation, but I was told that Mr. Granatelli said, well, they all have different numbers. Andy, bless your heart. But that doesn't help us at 180, 190, 210 miles an hour, whatever it is.
You ought to have looked him straight in the eye and said, if I can read the number, they're not going fast enough.
That's right. That's right. You're probably dropping out of the race if I can read the number.
So did you have a friend?
Well, they painted the 3 helmets differently.
Okay.
They had a blue one, a yellow one, and a red one. And they also did that to the, like a white wall on a tire. They painted them those colors. Well, it turned out, the crew couldn't necessarily, they weren't that big on radios in those days. The crew wasn't really sure necessarily which car was coming in. So that crew could be ready. And, of course, now we've got radios and spotters and everybody else. I think you could almost do these with one of those toy things. You know, take the driver clear out. But anyway, you just have to be here enough to learn. And I noticed, I listened the other day on one of the radio stations. They were doing some of the older races. I was listening to a CD, actually. And I noticed that Lou Palmer's first year was 58 when they had the huge crash up in turn.
Right.
Now, he's a rookie, okay?
They put him there because nothing ever happened.
Nothing ever happened in turn. But he was calling car numbers with no names, I noticed in that.
Huh.
And I'm not being critical. I would have probably done the same thing. But first of all, you're scared to death. Because he had this plethora of cars spinning. There's two more. There's 39. There's 17. There's, you know. But the point is, today you'll notice they probably won't do that. They'll call it by name, by driver.
But the NASCAR guys still call by numbers so often.
Oh,
personalize this thing.
It drives me crazy when they talk about the 20 car or the 40 car or the, you know, it's 20 or 40 or in the driver's name or whatever.
Right.
We know it's a car.
Exactly. No,
but it's a habit.
Right.
It's a habit thing.
So any memories stick out in your mind? I mean, thinking of, were you in turn two for Sneva's big accident in 75?
Yes, sir.
That had to be
my big world experience.
Oh.
But it was frightening. Because I looked down, and Eldon Rasmussen had just come out of the pits and was picking up speed and moving up the track, and here comes Sneed at a full bore, and he just ran over the right rear and caromed off into the fence over there. And in those days, the front bulkhead of the engine was the back seat of the driver's seat. The engine was literally fastened to that. Well, when the thing crashed, it bent the seat rest, the back seat backrest forward. The engine came off. Sneed was up in the fence, big ball of fire. The engine's sitting over here burning.
That would have been just beyond your vantage point?
It was like right there. I'm up here on that end of the suite, and it was right here. And honest to goodness, I thought he was going to be a crispy critter. The fire, that's their greatest fear is fire.
Oh, yeah. So.
And there was a lot of fire. As it turned out, it was just the excess fuel in the fuel lines is really what it was. And I think he had some minor burns on his wrist, but he raced the next weekend in Milwaukee. But I thought, you know, I got to cover this thing. I can't say how seriously injured he is or whatever because I'm not a doctor. Okay, and I mean, that was always the rule. You describe what you see, but you don't give condition. And that makes sense. The Speedway gives condition. But I thought, this guy's going to fry, and I'm going to tell the world about it. And I was really fearful. And I think some people kidded me about swallowing the microphone, you know. Oh, my God. Sid, if you listen to that play-by-play, Sid said, okay, howdy, now calm down, and we'll come back to you in a minute, you know.
I don't think I've ever heard it.
Yeah.
I hear the TV all the time, you know, Keith Jackson and Jackie Stewart.
Right. But, I mean, it was crazy. And what made me really concerned was the seat back, the driver's back seat, which was where the engine was attached to in part, had bent forward, as I said earlier. And, you know, the drivers in these rear-engine cars, they have to hike their behinds back and then push down to get out. He couldn't hike back because the seat was bent forward and had all that flame. I thought, he's going to sit there and fry, unless they get there very quickly. Now, they do get there very quickly, but your mind races.
Things probably slow motion, probably.
Yeah, really. And you think, oh, this is terrible. And but anyway, like I say, it all turned out good for him, bad for the car. And the interesting thing, if you've ever seen a still photograph of, and I love doing this, looking at people in the background, in the stand, if there's a wreck or something, and the majority of those people in the turn two suites didn't even see it. They were looking someplace else. You know, it just always astounds me. What are they looking at? You know, here you've got this huge crash in front of you,
right,
and about half of the people in the background of the picture are looking someplace else.
Well, that one happened so fast. I mean, he went from entering the turn to being
into the fence,
1,000 pieces, just like that.
Yeah, it happened so quickly.
You know, the one that I just noticed the other day, I don't know if you've seen the video of Kevin Kogan's accident in 1989 down here coming out of the fourth turn.
I've seen the video.
ABC had a wonderful, they had a camera right there on the end of the pit wall, and you could see the accident happening.
Yeah.
You know, he slid across the track and hit that inside wall.
Oh, yeah.
And there were, you know, several hundred people that were almost standing on the inside wall.
Oh, yeah.
And you just see this wave.
Everybody reacting.
So it is amazing. You know, it is almost interesting to watch the reactions of people as these events unfold.
Well, I think it was 1988 they asked me to work in the pits. That was the only year I was in the pits. And I was always hesitant to do that. And I'll be very honest, Mike, as they're afraid of fire, I'm afraid of fire. And it was always, and in those days, we had finally gone to fire suits for the radio crew in the pits. But I was always afraid. Remember when Lloyd Ruby pulled away before the hose was out and they had a fire, and Parnelli had a fire, if you remember? And I was always afraid that one of those big tanks was going to go up. I didn't want to be close to it. I didn't want to have to cover it. I just didn't want to be in that situation. So they asked me to be in pits. I said, okay, I will do the pits. I didn't want to be dropped from the network. So, sure, I'll do the pits. And they put me in the north pits. So Jerry Baker had been up there prior to that. And he said, howdy, I'll tell you what I do. I think maybe he was still in the pits. He said, at the pit entrance, there's a little extension there, and there's an ambulance that sits just inside the pit entrance against the inside curb at the fence. And he says, what I do at the start of the race is I go up there and stand behind that ambulance for the first four or five laps till they get sorted out a little bit, you know. Because, I mean, we have a history of having bad wrecks there.
Absolutely.
And so that's what I did. And I was amazed to realize that actually the pits were a lot more empty than I anticipated. You know, you look at pole day or something, and the pits are packed with all these people, you know, somebody's friend or company exec or something. And that's fine. But on race day, it really was kind of empty. It's the crews and the cars, and that's about it. And you have television, whoever that was. And in those days, it was a race in that it's whoever gets there first does the interview first. Well, we were so compact, self-contained by then, that I did Teo Fabi when the wheel came off in the pits that year, and Ludwig Heimrath was sitting in that ambulance at the north end. I got to talk to him, and I beat television, because television is still a bit cumbersome. And ABC would always hire a couple of college linemen to run interference for them. So you'd have a body of five, a group of five, coming. They have two 300-pound dudes, and your cameraman, your talent, and your mic guy. So, you know, about the time I finished with my interviews, they would come running up to do their shtick, which is fine. So it worked out very nicely for me. But I really didn't want to do the pits. Some people love that kind of stuff. I just, put me someplace else. And they said, this is a 1 year only. We just want you to do it this year. So that worked out. And then I'm not sure where I went after that, to be honest with you. But I ended up with Jenkins, and the story there was kind of interesting. Lou Palmer was a news guy, and Lou wanted to do the rundowns himself, which is fine. So Jenkins, his first year in the tower, decided he would do that because that's what Lou had done. Now, historically, Darrell Weibel, who was on staff at Purdue, did the rundowns. Charlie Brockman did them before him. Now let's go to Charlie Brockman for the rundown. You know, that
remember
kind of
those?
Thing. Okay. Well, they had finally developed it into a programmed thing within the race every X number of laps. I forget if it was 20 or 25. And it was even sponsored. So it was a revenue generator for the network as well. So we did the Bob Jenkins called me off-season. The first year he tried it, he said, Howdy, he says, would you... I was on the backstretch that year, which was a non-place almost because they're going so fast. But I was included in the go-around and that kind of thing. So anyway, he says, we're really wasting you on the backstretch. He says, would you like to come in the tower and do the rundowns for me? He said, Palmer did them. Last year I tried to do them, and I find I really don't want to mentally and visually come off the track. I want to stay out there.
That's interesting.
So would you like to come up here and do it? Yeah. You kidding me? You betcha. So I got to go to the tower. I did, I don't know, I think I did it 9 years, maybe 10, 9 years I was up there.